I used to love Cheers, that great TV show. I love the theme song as much as anything. Those opening lines, sometimes you always want to go where everybody knows your name and they're always glad you came. I watched an episode recently. I did not think it was nearly as funny as I used to think it was really funny, but it's a good show. Better theme song, I guess, ultimately. But it's a great little sort of slice of nostalgia. It's sort of, in a way, like, well, what we do with today's gospel reading. That is, we think we've got it all figured out. We think we know what it's about. It's the story of the prodigal son. But if we go back and read and look again, we realize it's not at all what we thought it was. It's not at all what we think it's about. Lots of preachers for lots of times have taught about the prodigal son, and it's not wrong. There are more than one character in this story. It's just that the title alone prejudices us. It makes us look in a certain direction at a certain character when there are really multiple characters. Biblical scholar Amy Jill Levine, AJ, focuses us and says, you know, it's really not the best name. It prejudices us in our thinking. We should probably have a title more like the parable of the father, or the parable of the two sons. Or my favorite one that she has is the parable of where's mom? What's going on? After all, mom might have pulled everybody back from the ledge here and all of their craziness. But it really has three main characters, not one main character. And to focus just on one is to miss the point of the parable. We know the prodigal part. We know the son goes off and spends all his money on dissolute living, which sounds like a lot of fun. I don't know exactly what dissolute living is. I need to do some research maybe on that, but it's a great turn of phrase. He loses everything, and he comes back and hopes just to be a slave. Doesn't even ask for everything. He realizes, in another great turn of phrase, he comes to himself and realizes how stupid he's really been. And he comes home, and the father runs out and welcomes him. And it is a beautiful image. It is an image of forgiveness and of hope, of reconciliation when all was thought to be lost. But if we stop there, we miss the whole story. In fact, we probably even miss the point of the story, because it starts not with Jesus talking to the people who he had come to be with. That is, he does not begin the conversation by saying he was speaking to the tax collectors and the prostitutes and the people who were coming to him. He's talking to the Pharisees and the scribes. He's talking to somebody who was upset about that group coming in. Now we have to pause for a minute and say the Pharisees are not bad people. In fact, they're the faithful people. They're the people who are in church every Sunday. They're the people who are in the altar guild and usher and help out and sing in the choir. They're the people who do all the work that keeps the community going. The Pharisees, I hate to tell you, are you and me. We're the Pharisees. We're the ones who are absolutely neck deep, trying to do all we can to make God's kingdom work and make it work in our head as well, and trying to understand it all. We're the people who are just there all the time. And if you're listening, Jesus does not always condemn the Pharisees. In fact, a lot of times he said, you're doing a pretty good job. You just missed a spot or two over here. You missed a little bit of God's grace. You missed a little bit of God's wideness and joy. And before you want to say, I'm not a Pharisee, let me tell you, if I invited 10 prostitutes to sit on the front row of today's service, I'm pretty sure I would have had more than a few people call me and tell me about how much I had things wrong. We can all have a little Pharisee in us from time to time. People with ideas of how God's kingdom is supposed to work, but then in practice it gets a lot harder. If we're really listening, the Pharisees are absolutely that older brother, the older brother who has stuck around and done everything that's been asked of them. He's the one who comes home and gets mad because his son, or his brother rather, who has just spent all the money and made a mess of things, who left him to do all the hard work, has suddenly come in and he gets the calf and the ring and the robe. And he's mad, and he's probably right to be mad. He has done all the work. He's done all the hard stuff. and then they get the parade instead of him. But God comes out, or the Father comes out, and says, don't be mad, it's going to be okay. Come back in, what was lost was found. And he tries to explain that it's a good thing when everyone's back. But the challenge of the parable is that it doesn't end with any resolution. We don't know if the older brother was willing to come back and celebrate. We don't know if the Pharisees were willing to celebrate what God was doing. We don't know how it ends. My wife and I, in between our middler and senior year, I don't know why they do this, but in seminary you were a junior, you start as a junior, then you're a middler, then you're a senior, whatever that means. But between my middler and senior year, that summer is the last moment of freedom for seminarians before we begin working in the church. So my wife and I decided to hike the Camino Santiago. That is, there's an ancient pilgrimage route across northern Spain, and it was one of the three great pilgrim routes of the ancient church, and medieval church for that matter. The idea was that you would walk from your home, wherever you were in Europe, to either Jerusalem or to Rome or Santiago, and to do so was to then get full forgiveness of your sins, a plenary indulgence. But the real point was always to go and to pray and to have time apart for God. And so my wife, who was a Spanish major, said, let's go try this. And I said, that sounds great. So we took 30 days to hike from Pamplona, Spain, all the way across to Santiago. Now I have to share that we started off, I'm an Eagle Scout. So we started off and I was thinking, oh, you've got to carry all this gear in your backpack. You got to have a tent and you got to have pots and pans and all this kind of stuff. About the third day we were on our trip, I realized we were on an ancient pilgrimage route. There were villages every 5 miles or so, and you didn't have to camp anything. So we literally took two-thirds of what we had and shipped it back home. We shipped 50 pounds worth of gear back to America. But the whole point was you went from place to place, and in each town, there is a beautiful little church. In some cases, a really big church, because it was an ancient pilgrimage route. From 400 AD to the present, there have been people walking this path, which is great. And it means that there are some fantastically cared for churches, ancient places of worship. But here's the crazy thing. As we walked that path with Spaniards and Italians, with Frenchmen and Germans, with Czechoslovakians and Canadians, people from around the world, and we only saw one American the whole time we were there, which is part of the fun. Another part of the fun was that it was also through the Rioja region of Spain, that is the wine-producing region. It's a good place to walk. It's so good a place to walk that in one town, they had a wine fountain instead of a water fountain. That was a good day. Anyway, but we walked from place to place, from town to town, and we would go to try and see those beautiful churches, but in largely secular Spain, they were always locked. Always locked. Every time we went into another town, we'd try to go to the church, and we'd pull on the door, and it would be locked, and no one knew where the key was. It didn't matter if it was Monday, it didn't matter if it was Sunday, it didn't matter if it was Friday afternoon. The churches were always locked. For the first 20 or 25 days of our walking and pilgrimage, we would go to the town, we would see if we could get in the church. The church would be locked, and so we would just hang out and talk with whoever we were walking with. It wasn't until we reached Galicia, which is a little northwestern section of Spain, beautiful green, verdant area, that we finally found a church that was open. It was not particularly beautiful. In fact, it was a squat little building, maybe about a story and a half. There was nothing about it that was beautiful in any way, shape, or form. Nothing extraordinary, nothing like we saw at different points where you had soaring cathedrals, magnificent gilded ceilings, all those kinds of things. No, it was a little building, but it had one key difference. That is, it had a priest who stood outside the doors and said the same thing, same just three, four words, in English, in German, in French, Italian, in every language he knew. He would just repeat it over and over again as the pilgrims walked by. He would say, come in and pray. Come in and pray. Come in and pray. And every pilgrim would go in and pray. We were walking at different points with different people, but at that point we were walking with this Canadian girl, sweet lady, who described herself as an agnostic, maybe even an atheist. But she walked right in with us and prayed and walked about the other side, and we asked her, why did you go in and pray? I thought you were agnostic to atheist. You were not sure about any of this stuff. She's like, because he invited me to come in. He welcomed me to come in. I stand outside the church on just about every service I can and welcome people because of that experience, being literally serving locked doors in more places than I could count, and then seeing someone stand outside and welcome them in. I realize this is a very clear image of how God sees the world welcoming us in. I do it because of that story. I do it because if we're really paying attention to the story, if we focus on the character that matters the most, on the Father, and what the Father is doing in this story, he goes out. He doesn't wait for the prodigal son to come in the door and say, gee, Dad, I'm sorry. He runs out into the street and welcomes him home. And then when the older brother is mad, he runs out to that boy and welcomes him home and invites him to come back. He doesn't wait. He goes out and invites people in. It's the greatest image of all. It's the most extravagant, absurd image of God. I mean, this is a father who literally hands over half of everything he has to one son just because he asked for it. I don't know if either of my boys ever asked for that, but they're not going to get half of my stuff if they do. But that's God, who gives generously, and this runs out and welcomes us in the street and rejoices with us. It's what we're called to be as God's church and as God's people. People who go outside our doors and welcome them in to say, look at our beautiful space. Look at all we have to offer. Look at this community of love and of hope and of faith. Come in and see God. Come in and pray. Come in and pray. It's what I hope and pray that we can be as a community of faith, a place that mirrors God's welcoming presence to the world, that runs out these doors to say, come on in. A place that when they do come in, they realize that God is near. And it's a place where if we don't all know your name, we will definitely be glad you came. It's a place, I pray, of deep welcome, where we are all God's children. And we rejoice because we're all home. Amen.